COVID-19. Dwyer added, for instance, if we just focus on China for now, we know there were influenza-like respiratory illnesses in Wuhan in late 2019. In fact, researchers looked at data from more than 76,000 cases for the WHO report to see whether these could have been what they now call COVID-19. But work is already underway to reanalyze those data using different techniques to see if they have missed any earlier cases. Talks are also underway to see whether blood donations in China in 2019 can be analyzed to see if they contain antibodies to SARS-CoV-2. This would tell us whether the people who donated those samples had been infected by the virus. These types of investigations take time. Dwyer said, then there is what we can learn from molecular epidemiology, the genetic makeup of the virus and its spread. For instance, if we find a lot of variation in the genetic sequence of early samples of SARS-CoV-2, this tells us there had already been transmission for some time, adding, that's because the virus doesn't mutate unless it infects and transmits. We can use modeling to say what might have happened up to 3 or more weeks beforehand. Researchers also need to link those molecular epidemiology data to actual clinical data. Until now, those data have largely been separate, with the molecular data held in research or university laboratories and the patient data held elsewhere. They need to make those connections to tell them which infections were related and how far back in time they go. There are also many biological samples sitting in labs around the world that they need to analyze, and not just in Wuhan. So they have to do a bit of detective work to locate them and analyze them to understand the pattern of disease and to help sort out the origin. There is no central database of samples and what antibodies or genetic material they might contain. For instance, there are SARS-CoV-2 positive blood donations in the US and France, and cases in Italy, and there is sewage testing in Spain. These are places with early outbreaks of respiratory illnesses that may help researchers find out if SARS-CoV-2 was circulating earlier than we first thought. Researchers also need more studies into the role of frozen food products in transmitting the virus. Although they considered the cold chain a possible pathway to transmission, they still don't know how big a factor this was, if at all. Dwyer noted, finally, there is ongoing sampling of animals and the environment for signs of SARS-CoV-2 or related viruses. Can we find the parent virus, the one that eventually mutated into SARS-CoV-2 in a bat in a cave somewhere? Where do we look? At bats across the Southeast Asia, Central Asia, into Europe? Dwyer continued, we need to look at the range of these bats and where they live. These types of investigations can take ages. Can we find the virus in an intermediary animal, and if so, what type of animal and where? Again, these are difficult studies to set up. The key here is to keep trying to work together and avoid the over-politicization of the whole exercise. Dwyer concluded, rather than blaming governments, we need to foster cooperation and trust between investigators, between and within countries. This is not only help us during this pandemic, it's the key to managing future pandemics. The more cooperative we are, the more likely we are to get the best results. We have to make sure politics doesn't muck that up. Meanwhile, leaders of 23 countries and the World Health Organization, WHO, recently backed an idea to create an international treaty that would help the world deal with future health emergencies similar to the coronavirus pandemic that is ravaging the globe. The idea of such a treaty, which would ensure universal and equitable access to vaccines, medicines, and diagnostics for pandemics, was floated by the chairman of European Union leaders Charles Michel at the G20 summit last November. Diplomats say WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom endorsed the idea at its governing body in January, but formal negotiations have not begun. Tedros said during a virtual news conference, "The time to act is now. The world cannot afford to wait until the pandemic is over to start planning for the next one. We must not allow the memories of this crisis to fade and go back to business as usual." The treaty proposal got the formal backing of the leaders of Fiji, Portugal, Romania, Britain, Rwanda, Kenya, France, Germany, Greece, Korea, Chile, Costa Rica, Albania, South Africa, Trinidad and Tobago, the Netherlands, Tunisia, Senegal, Spain, Norway, Serbia, Indonesia, Ukraine, and the WHO. Speaking at the same news conference, Michel said, "COVID-19 has exposed weaknesses and divisions across our societies, and now it is time to come together as one global community to build a pandemic defense for future generations." The main goal of such a treaty would be to strengthen the world's resilience to future pandemics through better alert systems, data sharing, research, and the production and distribution of vaccines, medicines, diagnostics, and personal protective equipment. The treaty would also state that the health of humans, animals, and the planet are all connected and should lead to shared responsibility, transparency, and cooperation globally. Tedros said the treaty would help to tackle gaps exposed by COVID-19, strengthen implementation of international health regulations, and also provide a framework cooperation in areas such as pandemic prevention and response. Tedros said the treaty, which could be taken forward by the World Health Assembly, would be based on the WHO Constitution, including the principles of health for all and no discrimination, adding that it was for WHO member states to determine the contents and whether it was ratified. He also said that many world countries have reacted positively to the proposal.
Inside Israel. About half of secular Israelis, 48%, are unwilling to live alongside Haredim or ultra-Orthodox Jews. That's according to a poll conducted by the Aluma Equality Advocacy Group and the ERI Research Institute in Israel. According to the poll, 69% of secular Israelis said they would rather have Arab neighbors than Haredi ones. This, as another 62% said they would rather live next to Bedouins, who are also Palestinian descendants, than with the ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Well, the situation is not very exciting. It's not very... we didn't choose it, but it happened. I mean, quite a few times in the year, in every year, all the time there is, you know, opportunities when the secular and the non-secular have, very complicated discussions between each other. And with the corona, we've seen it so many times, and I hope it's going to go down, but it looks that, there is a big wall between the secular people and the non-secular people.
This is a record high of hostility towards the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. According to the author of the study, Dr. Gali Sambira, there's no doubt that the greatest tension exists between the ultra-Orthodox and secular Israelis. The secular Israelis who identify themselves as liberals are only liberal towards the sectors that are convenient for them, the study noted. For example, they are liberal towards Arabs, but not towards the ultra-Orthodox Jews. This while traditional Israelis are liberal towards religious Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox. Each group considers itself to be liberal. Apparently, the coronavirus pandemic also increased the polarization. 74% of Haredim reported that the situation has become worse towards them. They feel it in real life as well. One respondent to the survey said, "If I cough on the bus, I feel like a hired assassin. If a Haredi gets on the bus, he immediately feels like an enemy to the people." The results of the poll showed the evident polarization between different sectors in Israel. Among the different groups in Israel, the greatest tension exists between the ultra-Orthodox and secular Israelis. Secularism is the point of contention between Zionists and the ultra-Orthodox community inside and outside of Israel. Many in Israel and, of course, across the world wrongly believe that Zionism is a part of Judaism, or is compatible with Judaism, or is even the main part of Judaism. All of those are actually false, according to ultra-Orthodox Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. Zionism was created to negate Judaism. Zionism was created to replace Judaism. The differences between Judaism and Zionism are vast and profound. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Shira on Twitter says, "I guess I've always thought I was very familiar with those rifts. Like, I thought the main Orthodox secular rift was between the Haredim and secular Israelis. But I didn't realize how much animosity there was between secular Israelis and the group I most identify with, Dati Leumi." Genesis says, "They are very secular, though, and this often puts them at odds with other right-wing parties because they think the Hasidic Haredim should do their military service just like other Israelis." Gil says, "Israeli society has an aggressive counter-push to it between Haredim and secular authorities. I've only seen it up close a few times, but it's scary on both sides."
Each time that there is a trial, that he must stand for a trial, he's not coming, or he's making a closer for Israel or something. And we are really mad at him.
Okay, well, the question here is what the definition of Judaism and Jews is. Basically, Judaism is a religion, a pure religion, the service of Almighty God, the practice of the commandments of the Torah, the Jewish requirements, versus the new nationalistic political movement, Zionism, which drops everything holy and everything attached to God. One of the basics of Judaism is a concept that Jewish people are in exile. For 2,000 years, we are forbidden to fight other nations. Then we have this new movement, which fights for their nationalism and for their country. These people, from the very beginning, are embarrassed by traditional Judaism. They didn't want to see this continuing. They don't want to see this in their way. But still in all, we are here. Our communities are strong. We are loyal to God. We don't fight our neighbors. We practice our religion. And this is unappreciated by them. From the very beginning, they attempted and they did all in their ability to uproot Judaism, the belief in God, from the masses of the Jewish people. Aside of their movement, who were people that unfortunately left Judaism for a long time, they attempted to uproot Judaism from the remaining communities in the Holy Land, or those who immigrated to the Holy Land. They did everything they could to impose their lifestyle and their beliefs and their approach upon everyone. They hoped that Jewish tradition would no longer continue, but thank God they were unsuccessful. They are unsuccessful. Well, unfortunately, the mainstream media in Israel, as in so many other parts of the world, are on the other side, are on the side of the secular people in Israel. Unfortunately, they don't respect the community that lived in the Holy Land way before Zionism and this new movement came up to the Holy Land. They don't respect the serious communities in the Holy Land, the serious leadership of our communities, and you know, all these communities are totally disregarded, not respected, and basically oppressed.
Much of the ultra-Orthodox community considers itself anti-Zionist. Much of the friction between the secular community and the ultra-Orthodox community revolves around the definition of Judaism and what Zionism means for both groups. The propaganda that Zionists have churned out for the past 100 years have confused and conflicted Zionism and Judaism. The average person thinks that Israel is the Jewish so-called state and that Zionism is Judaism and wouldn't know the difference. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political and it is also national. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is completely religious. Thus, a Jew by definition is somebody who accepted the Jewish religion, or somebody that is defined by the Jewish religion as a Jew. According to Zionism, however, Jewish identity is political and it is defined the same way that would define any nationalist, like a Canadian or a Frenchman. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is centered around a nation-state which they randomly decided is the nation-state that was incepted in 1948 onto Palestinian lands that they call Israel. So you can see that the differences are immense, and the friction has been there since the inception of Palestinian lands in 1948 and has only grown far apart. The latest poll by the Aluma Equality Advocacy Group and the ERI Research Institute in Israel on the tension between secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community only confirms this schism. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Baruch on Twitter says, the same way the Israeli left and secular parties uses Haredim as a boogeyman to galvanize their electorate, they use the settlers. We have huge budgets. We upset the Arabs and the world. We're fanatics. What type of kippah do secular Israeli politicians wear when they're at a religious ceremony or place? I've noticed that often left-wing politicians use knitted kippahs, customary among the religious Zionists, and right-wing politicians put black kippahs, like the ultra-Orthodox Haredim. Brian says, you must admit that it's a similar thing going on in secular Israeli minds when Haredim start moving into their neighborhoods, and they begin to worry that the Haredim will start demanding that shops close on Shabbat, no driving on the street, etc. We'll be right back.
it was certainly not done for the peaceful, religious, God-fearing community that lived in the Holy Land way before this movement came. This was not done for refugees from the Holocaust, who are seriously religious people and very strongly opposed the movement of Zionism even before the Holocaust. This was done for the people who dropped Judaism for a long time and insisted that they want to have a sovereign homeland for themselves, which happens to be in total contrast to Judaism and Jewish tradition. And they forced so many people to go along with their philosophy. Unfortunately, so many refugees from the Holocaust that didn't have any other choice, and they were like almost forced to immigrate to the Holy Land. This was not in favor of so many people. So many people who could have had so many other alternatives, and unfortunately they were forced to the Holy Land against their will. Now, to make this very clear, this is not in favor of the Jewish people as a whole. This is not in favor of God or God's religion. This is in favor of a community of people who decided to drop God and drop Jewish religion and do their political movement on the account of so many people, Jewish and non-Jewish alike. Okay, religious Jews follow God, believe in God, believe in the basics of Jewish belief, practice the Jewish religion, the commandments, 613 commandments of the Holy Torah. One of the basics of Jewish belief is that we are in exile and we are forbidden to fight other nations. We are required to live in peace with our neighbors, not to harm or, God forbid, kill anyone. On the other side, we have the Zionist movement, which is the, generally speaking, the secular movement of Israel in general terms, who don't practice Judaism, don't believe in God. As I say, they simply don't believe in God. This was from the very beginning of Zionism to the present day. Masses of Jewish people, unfortunately, and they have nothing in their way to continue to support their national movement and their state of Israel, which they believe and they insist to call this a Jewish state. They would oppress other people, as unfortunately we see already for decades, kill and steal everything which is forbidden in Judaism. We need to be very clear, and we need to understand a very simple concept. There is a great difference between Judaism and Zionism. Judaism is a religion, an ancient, old, thousands of year religion, and masses of Jewish people, basically the entire Jewish people that follow this religion for thousands of years. Then we have a relatively new movement, a national movement, which has nothing to do with religion, has nothing to do with godliness, a purely political movement, basically transforming Judaism from a religion into a nationalism. Should never be confused. In addition, my final point is that we have to understand, and masses of people in the world need to understand, that the state of Israel as a government, as a movement, in no way represents world Jewry. It's a group of people who happen to be from Jewish descent, who don't follow anything of Judaism, and still and all, they do everything they can, and all crimes they commit, all violations of God's word and God's Torah, and unfortunately, they still insist to represent all Jews. This is not the case, and should never be. They should never be considered as the representation of myself, my family, my communities, or the Jewish world at large.
The new data coming out of Israel on the tensions between secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox community gives clues of a crumbling society. The data shows that it is merely impossible for secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox community to coexist side by side. They believe that they are too different to live in the same neighborhood. The Israeli project meant to bring the two groups together to justify it as a home for all Jews. But it seems that not all Jews feel this way, as there are some fundamental issues that Israel can't seem to get rid of. For now, it seems that the crumbling apart of Israeli society continues, all the while politicians have immersed themselves in a fourth election after three failed ones in less than 2 years.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The creation of domestic technology is one of the benefits of the sanctions for our country.
First of all, America's economic siege and sanction against us and against some other countries is a big crime committed by a government. Sanctions should not be simply viewed as a political or diplomatic tactic. They're really a criminal activity that they impose sanctions on a nation, with the result being that it cannot import medication and medical instruments, and foodstuff is really a big crime. Of course, we are thankfully capable of pulling ourselves out of this situation, and we have indeed done so, but there are some countries that cannot do so. This crime can only be committed by a government which can massacre 220,000 people in the course of one day, reference to the nuclear bombardment of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the US. This crime was committed by powers such as the US. You should know that sanctions and economic siege are definitely big criminal activities. This is the first point.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Despite this, the sanction against our country, this crime committed against our country, the sanctions had certain benefits as they managed to turn this threat into an opportunity. In other words, our diligent youth showed determination by providing the needs of the country in some of the areas on which the country was completely dependent. They produced those goods inside the country. This is different from the surge in production. This is actually the creation of technology inside the country. It is actually an endeavor to do something new in the country. Sometimes, one witnesses reports broadcast on television about such endeavors. Youth manufacture products which render the country self-sufficient, since their products are even of higher quality than their foreign counterparts and they are also cheaper. These products are produced by our own youth and we can use them quite willingly. So they cut off our dependence in certain areas. This became a lesson for us when we watch a youth on television saying that he as well as others achieved a certain feat. This becomes a lesson for us.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
A Minneapolis police trainer who instructed Derek Chauvin in the use of force told the former police officer's murder trial on Tuesday, 6th of April, that placing a knee on a suspect's neck when they are already subdued is not authorized. Lieutenant Johnny Mercil told the court that at the time George Floyd was arrested last May, police department policies still permitted the use of neck restraints, using an arm or side of a leg when a suspect was being assaultive. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Chris McReel. The piece is titled, "Knee on Subdued Suspect's Neck Not Allowed, Police Trainer Tells Chauvin Trial." Stay with us for more of Chris McReel's article. A Minneapolis police trainer who instructed Derek Chauvin in the use of force told the former police officer's murder trial on Tuesday, 6th of April, that placing a knee on a suspect's neck when they are already subdued is not authorized. Lieutenant Johnny Mercer told the court that at the time George Floyd was arrested last May, police department policies still permitted the use of neck restraints, using an arm or side of a leg when a suspect was being assaultive. But he said the training did not include the use of a knee, as Derek Chauvin used for more than 9 minutes on the 46-year-old African-American man in his custody. Johnny Mercer said putting a knee on the neck is not unauthorized in making an arrest, but that it is not permitted if the suspect is in handcuffs or otherwise subdued. George Floyd was in handcuffs for several minutes before he was forced into the prone position on the ground, and Derek Chauvin applied his knee to his neck. Chauvin, a 45-year-old, has denied charges of second and third degree murder and manslaughter over George Floyd's death, which prompted mass protests for racial justice across the United States and other parts of the world. He faces up to 40 years imprisonment if convicted of the most serious charge. Three other police officers face charges of aiding and abetting murder and manslaughter. Johnny Mercer, a martial arts expert specializing in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, said he trained police officers that the use of force has to be reasonable when it starts and when it stops. The prosecution is seeking to show that even if Derek Chauvin felt that he was using a legitimate level of force when he got George Floyd on the ground, keeping his knee on the detained man's neck for more than 9 minutes was not reasonable. There came a point at which it should have been lifted. Mercer said police officers are trained to use force in proportion to the level of resistance that you're getting. He agreed that it should be reduced as the threat from a suspect diminishes. The prosecutor showed Mercer a picture of Derek Chauvin restraining George Floyd as he lay prone and asked if that level of force would be authorized if the subject was under control and handcuffed. The police lieutenant replied, "I would say no." The defense attempted to get Johnny Mercer to agree that a training manual showed an officer placing his knee on the back of a neck during handcuffing. But Mercer said the picture showed the knee was on the shoulder and it was the shin across the neck. The distinction is crucial because it means the pressure point is away from where it is most dangerous. Mercer was the latest in a succession of Derek Chauvin's former colleagues to give evidence for the prosecution. Earlier on Tuesday, Sergeant Kerr Yang, a 24-year Minneapolis police veteran who now heads training in crisis intervention, said Derek Chauvin was instructed to recognize whether a detained individual is in crisis and needs medical assistance. He agreed that intoxication from drugs or alcohol can be a crisis. George Floyd's girlfriend has testified that he was addicted to opioids, and another witness said he appeared to be high shortly before his arrest. Nicole McKenzie, the police department's medical support coordinator, testified that Derek Chauvin was trained in dealing with drug overdoses and in giving CPR. She said police officers are obliged to render immediate first aid in a critical situation and not to simply wait for an ambulance to arrive. Nicole McKenzie said police officers are instructed in how to recognize and respond to a person who is unresponsive, including taking a pulse, and measures to get them breathing again. A video of George Floyd's arrest shows one of the police officers dismissing his pleas that he can't breathe on the grounds that it takes a lot of oxygen to talk. Just because they're speaking does not mean they are breathing adequately, said Nicole McKenzie, the police department's medical support coordinator. One of the challenges for the prosecution is to persuade the jury that Derek Chauvin, and not the Minneapolis Police Department, bears responsibility for the methods he used. On Monday, 5th of April, the city's police chief, Medaria Arredondo, attempted to paint Derek Chauvin as a rogue officer, going far beyond his training and regulations in his use of force. To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape or form is anything that is by policy, Arredondo told the trial. The defense suggested Derek Chauvin was merely following his training by Minneapolis police. His lawyer, Eric Nelson, put it to Arredondo that his department's policies did permit neck restraints under certain circumstances at the time of George Floyd's death. These included the unconscious neck restraint used to cut off the blood flow to the brain. However, that hold was only supposed to be used on people exhibiting active aggression or sustained resistance to arrest. Police Chief Arredondo said, there had been such a policy, but there was no justification for the continued pressure on George Floyd's neck after he stopped resisting. The day began with an attempt by Morris Hall, the passenger in the vehicle with George Floyd at the time of his detention, to invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination and not give evidence. Previous witnesses testified that Morris Hall supplied drugs to George Floyd. The prosecution opposed the application for Hall to be granted a blanket right not to testify on the grounds that there are relevant questions that do not risk self-incrimination. The judge asked for a list of questions that might be asked. Three other police officers involved in George Floyd's death are scheduled to be tried together later this year on charges of aiding and abetting murder and manslaughter. The trial of Derek Chauvin continues.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
A meeting that has raised hopes to revive 2015 Iran nuclear deal. After the withdrawal of Washington from the agreement under Donald Trump, it is said the United States will be part of this meeting in Vienna to hold separate talks with the signatories. Tehran says the Islamic Republic will not hold any negotiations with the U.S. regarding the deal, stressing that first off, all the sanctions must be lifted.
The roadmap is quite clear, removal of sanctions of the United States, which has been imposed by the United States against Iran, extraterritorial sanctions and illegal sanctions that the United States has imposed on Iran altogether, should be removed. In response, Iran is also ready to stop the remedial measures which has been implemented in response to the non-compliance by the United States and the other parties in the JCPOA.
a representative of Iran's atomic energy organization would be there. And if it is true, would you please tell us what does that mean?
The delegation of the Islamic Republic of Iran is actually leading by His Excellency Araghchi. The delegation is consisting of different people, including and dignitaries, including experts from Iran's Atomic Energy Agency. It does mean that, you know, there is an agenda for tomorrow.
Khatibzadeh also added that the Tuesday meeting will focus on returning the other JCPOA signatories to their commitments. A video conference was held on Friday, led by the EU participants, to discuss a full return of the US to the JCPOA. Participants also emphasized their commitment to salvage the agreement and discuss ways to ensure the return to its full and effective implementation. Earlier, Iran's foreign minister urged the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to play a constructive role in the upcoming meeting and the agreement. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the remarks in separate phone calls with his British and French counterparts. The US reimposed illegal sanctions on Iran after it withdrew from the nuclear deal. A year later, Iran began rolling back its commitments, saying the remaining parties, including Europeans, have failed to compensate for the US pullout. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif will not be in Vienna for the talks, as he is on a tour to four Central Asian countries. Therefore, the Iranian delegation would be headed by Deputy for Political Affairs Sayed Abbas Araghchi. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Palestinian children continue to suffer due to Israel's inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian children over the past decade under the watchful eye of the international community. Last year alone, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinian children. During a press conference marking the annual event, Palestinians demanded that Israeli forces be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian children.
Israeli soldiers are acting with impunity because they feel that they will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Such policies have encouraged Israeli soldiers to violate our rights. The international community must take concrete steps to prosecute those Israeli soldiers who kill and maim us on a daily basis.
Scores of Palestinian children lost their lives during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies due to Israel's use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinian children were systematic.
As we mark Palestinian Child Day, Israel continues to commit grave violations against Palestinian children, including wounding them and killing them. Israel also violates the social, economic, and cultural rights. The Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life for Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged 3 wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children.
The Zionist enemy violates the rights of Palestinian children to live. They have bombed the homes where Palestinian children live and have deprived them from receiving proper education and health care. Palestinian children are even deprived from the right of movement.
Palestinian Child Day highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade. Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Going without food may seem extreme to some, but for many Yemenis, it's a part of daily life. After Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in 2015, it quickly moved to encircle the nation, and huge swaths of the country have been facing chronic malnutrition ever since. Now, supporters abroad are refusing food as well, in an effort to draw attention to Yemeni's desperate plight.
We're here outside the White House, where activists with the Yemeni Liberation Movement have gathered to call for an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led siege on Yemen. Many of them have decided to put their bodies on the line and are now on day 6 of an ongoing hunger strike in solidarity with the Yemeni people starving under the blockade.
We're here at Washington, D.C. We came all the way from Michigan, and we're in Washington, D.C. to demand an end for the U.S. For the U.S.'s support on the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen, which is causing the biggest humanitarian crisis in the last 100 years. Over 22 million people are experiencing starvation, and every 75 seconds a child dies from starvation.
For the millions deprived of basic supplies like medicine and fuel, every day is a struggle for survival. According to UNICEF, over two-thirds of Yemen's population, or more than 20 million people, are in need of humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, activists say the U.S. government has been working continuously to enable the Saudi aggression.
So the United States is not only complicit in this genocide, they are wholeheartedly and completely supporting it at every possible aspect, militarily, with intelligence and logistics. They have provided billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in weapon sales to the Saudi government, as well as helping the Saudi government enforce the fuel blockade, which is currently enforced since December 2020.
It's been nearly a week since they've eaten, and going without food is starting to take a toll. But these activists are determined to carry on, saying the situation in Yemen has gotten so bad that they simply have no other choice.
Because it gets pretty foggy and hazy. And I think we're also realizing this is only a fraction of what Yemeni people are having to deal with. So we want folks at home to really understand that.
And I just want to add, you know, so many folks say, like, why are y'all starving yourselves? You know, like, you should be doing something else. And really, it's a last resort. If you look at hunger strikes from, you know, the Irish hunger strike or prison hunger strikes, these are people whose power was taken away, and this is a last resort.
Wyatt Reed, Washington.
After a lull of around 20 months, street protests against Indian rule resurfaced in Indian-controlled Kashmir. That came after three suspected anti-India fighters were killed by government forces in an anti-militancy operation on Friday in the southern district of Pulwama. Officials say two of the three men were involved in killing a policeman guarding a local politician's house. Like in past, hundreds of people marched towards the site of the gun battle in support of the fighters. They chanted slogans against the Indian rule in the region. Government forces used tear gas and fired shotgun pellets at the stone-throwing protesters, injuring four people. India imposed a security crackdown on Kashmir after August 5, 2019, when it unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomy. The crackdown, coupled with the COVID-19 lockdown, kept people from taking to streets. Indian officials call the Kashmir unrest, quote, Pakistan-sponsored terrorism, a charge that Islamabad denies.
Pakistan. Through social media, Pakistan is instigating, encouraging and radicalizing the youth of Kashmir to join terrorist outfits. The youth are fearless and innocent. They don't know what they are doing. Whoever chooses this path should remember the outcome is either jail or death.
A senior journalist and political analyst from Kashmir says there is pent-up anger among people and this is going to be critical this summer.
A series of laws that have come, including other things which are happening at such a galloping pace. So now people are really trying to express their anger, you know, through one way or the other. You saw the protests in Jamia Masjid, the clashes there. You saw, you know, government degree college in two South Kashmir districts. So I think this summer is going to be very tricky.
Last month, India and Pakistan agreed to abide by their 2003 ceasefire agreement along the de facto borders dividing Kashmir. However, the crackdown by security forces and attacks by militants continue unabated. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan since their independence from the British rule in 1947. The two countries have fought wars over the region and claimed sovereignty over it. After witnessing decades of violence, people in Kashmir aim to see a peaceful future. Majority of people living here believe global powers need to play their part before the animosity between India and Pakistan claims more lives here. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The U.S. and Iran will go back to the negotiating table in Vienna to talk about the nuclear deal. The U.S. State Department made this bombshell announcement on Friday, and it's now the talk of the town. But a high-ranking source in Iran says that Tehran has no such a plan before Washington lifts all sanctions against Iran. Since Biden took office, Iran has made it clear that it is the U.S. that should return to the nuclear deal first, as it was the one that unilaterally and illegally withdrew from the agreement. This stance is shared by Iranian lawmakers as well.
Our leader has put the final word on it. No talks with the U.S. until all sanctions are lifted. After Iran made sure that all of the illegal sanctions are no longer in place, then we would return to our commitments.
There is no point in negotiating to the U.S. while it was the one that broke the international rules and withdrew from the accord. We retaliated by scaling back some of our obligations to the deal, and that's based on Article 35 and 36 of the JCPOA. We have not violated anything.
Senior officials from all signatories to the nuclear deal, namely Iran, France, Germany, the UK, Russia, and China, will gather in the Austrian capital on Tuesday to discuss ways to salvage the ailing accord. The Biden administration is also sending a team of experts to Vienna. Washington hopes to talk to the Iranian representatives over a step-by-step timetable that would bring both sides to compliance with the accord.
And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
There's no step-by-step plan, says Tehran. Iranian officials say the aim of the Vienna session would be to rapidly finalize the removal of all sanctions and nothing else.
Iran will not accept any step-by-step proposal. We think that there will be just one step, lifting all the sanctions. After the verification, Iran will come back to its commitment.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran responded by ramping up its enrichment of uranium and limiting international monitoring of its nuclear sites. Meanwhile, Biden has indicated that he's willing to clean up his predecessor's mess, but has taken no practical steps to do so. Observers say any headway should be made before Iran's presidential elections in June, which could lead to the formation of a new Iranian negotiating team and more delays.
So the bottom line is, there will be no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. in Vienna or anywhere else. Iran says any return by the U.S. to the nuclear deal will not need any negotiations. Once it's in the deal, Iran will reverse all its remedial steps and will go back to full compliance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Most government hospitals have remained largely empty because of a nationwide strike action by resident doctors who constitute a large percentage of medical doctors in government hospitals in Nigeria. Consultancy rooms have remained empty because of the absence of medical doctors to attend to patients. Doctors' union officials said they are tired of the government failing to live up to its promises of settling their salaries and other benefits on time. Representatives of the Nigerian government met with labor leaders behind closed doors in a last-minute effort to avert the strike, but apparently the meeting ended in a deadlock. The government appealed to the doctors to consider the damage their withdrawal of services will cause to Nigeria's health system. But the resident doctors said the government should keep its several promises. This strike is coming at a challenging period, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, with only about 800,000 Nigerians vaccinated. In a country with a population of close to 200 million, Nigeria has 163,000 COVID-19 cases, out of which 2,038 people have died so far. The doctors' union said all the resident doctors at the COVID-19 centers have joined the strike and withdrew their services.